This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jeannie Lee from the University of Arizona. Today we're joined by Dr. Roger Thomas and his new book, Counting Dreams, The Life and Writings of the Loyalist Nun Nomura Boto. It was published by Cornell University Press earlier this year. Dr. Thomas currently teaches and researches about Japanese literature at Illinois State University. This book looks into the writings, life story, and legacy of Nomura Boto, who was a Buddhist nun, writer, poet, and activist during Japan's Bakumatsu era, which is roughly between 1850 and 1870. Through translations and analysis of her poems and diaries, Dr. Thomas illustrates the adventurous life of a complex woman during Japan's drastic changes towards modernization. So welcome, Dr. Thomas. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've written a lot about early modern Japanese poetry. So what do you research about right now, and why does it interest you?
Well, ever since my dissertation, well, a long time ago, which was on early modern poetry, that has been the focus of my research. Most recently, I've shifted a little bit toward philology, the nexus between philology and poetry, poetics especially, and also Kotodama thought. I've done some work on that as well.
Interesting. Do you remember what first interested you to getting to studies of Japanese poetry?
Well, I'd have to credit my dissertation director. I had taken several courses from her before in graduate school, and I recall especially one seminar where we talked about some early modern poets, and I discovered poets like Akemi and Kotomichi, and I found them very fascinating because I had never associated the early modern period with waka poetry. You hear waka poetry and you think Heian period, you know. And so it was an exciting discovery for me, and I went from there to look into poetics, and sort of found my niche there, I guess.
Nice. And the protagonist of our book today is Nomura Boto, a nun who lived in the first half of the 19th century around the Fukuoka area. What led you to this project?
Well, again, one of the poets that I focused on and Okuma Kotomichi, who was also a native of Fukuoka and who was Boto's teacher. And I approached her through him, basically. Much of a chapter of my 2008 book is dedicated to Kotomichi and his poetry, and I had studied his poetry and written and published about it quite fairly extensively, and so I knew of her through him, And that's how I became acquainted with her. I approached her through her poetry, which is different from how most people approach her. They approach her through her political activism, and I kind of went the other route. But I think that many people are aware of her activism and her political activity and all that, but actually she had a very solid reputation regionally as a poet before she got involved in any of that. So it's important to keep that in mind as well.
Yes, that's a very interesting aspect in the book that we will return to later. But as I covered very briefly in the introduction, Nomura Bando has a lot of identities. She's a nun, she's a writer, she's a poet, she's an activist. But all in all, who is she? What did she do?
Well, she was from a middle-ranking samurai family. And when people think of the samurai, they think it's a discreet class, and it is, but there were several ranks within the samurai caste, and she was in the middle rank, which was well above the lowly ashigaru, but not as high as the karo and ministers and things like that. So her family commanded a fairly substantial stipend. I think it was something like 400 and something. Well, anyway, it was a fairly sizable stipend that they had, and so she grew up in not extremely privileged circumstances, but certainly not destitute either, and much of her life was typical of women of that period. Women from her class typically went to serve in the household of a higher family, to learn etiquette, to learn manners, and they also received instruction in the traditional arts. And she did that as well during her teenage years. Her life course was a little bit different after that, because she had a brief marriage at the end of her teenage years, and it ended in divorce. Of course, the conventional wisdom would have you think that a demodori from that period would face very bleak prospects of ever marrying again, but she did marry. She remarried fairly soon, and had a very happy marriage, and she shared a passion for poetry with her husband. They both studied under Koto Michi, and after he died, she became a nun, took the name Boto, which means facing to the east, which some people have read some activism into that already, because she was facing east from Fukuoka, which could be either the capital or Edo. It could be either one, but some people have tried to read some activism into that. I'm really not convinced. I think that her activism really came a little bit later than that. She traveled to Kyoto and met with various loyalists there, apparently. Just when her radicalization began is difficult to pinpoint exactly, but it certainly was in place when she started corresponding with Kuniyomi and other loyalists in the area. Takasugi Shinsaku stayed at her hermitage, and at first unbeknownst to her, but she later went and visited him there, and that became a major point in her conviction, in her sentencing, that she had given aid and put up these dangerous factions. And anyway, she was arrested herself in the purge of 1865, a major purge in the domain, and then she was put under house arrest for several months, both at her family home, the Nomura family home. She was under house arrest there, and then she was transferred to her natal home, the Urano home. She was transferred to her natal home, and it was there that she was sent for interrogation. She was sentenced. She fully expected to be executed, as a good number of her comrades were, but she was given the more lenient sentence of banishment, which wasn't really lenient, actually, because she was confined to a single cell prison on the remote island of Himeshima. And then Takasugi arranged for a band of men to come and break her out of her prison and spirited her away to the Choshu domain, where she spent the remainder of her years. And so that's basically the course of her life. I mentioned this to a few of the students in my class. They said, "What's your book about?" And I told them the basic story of Boto. And one of the students said, "Gee, Sensei, that would make a great anime."
Yeah, I definitely agree. And yeah, this all sounds very exciting and adventurous. What do we need to know about the historical backgrounds of this time? Why did she have such a exciting life?
Well, it's important to know the history of the Bakumatsu generally, of course, but more specifically the circumstances that led to the rise of loyalism or restorationism, or as it's known in Japanese, the Sonno Joi, those terms. And that was especially brought to a head by the arrival of Commodore Perry. And this put the Bakufu, the shogunate, in the awkward position of having to steer a course between appeasing isolationist elements in the country, and at the same time having to deal with an evolving global situation. And so anyway, there is that. There's also, you'd have to know a little bit about the intellectual foundation of loyalism, which had its roots in nativism and kokugaku. And I know that Mark McNally insists that those are different entities, actually. It's also important to understand the political situation in the Fukuoka domain in particular, the Toyama domain was one of, or not Toyama, Fukuoka. I keep thinking of where my wife is from. I'm sorry. The Fukuoka domain, which was one of the most powerful Tozama domains. And of course, a lot of the Tozama domains had kind of uneasy relationships with the shogunate, but with the Fukuoka domain, it was a little bit different, because they played the role of a kind of hashiwatashi, or middleman, between the shogunate and the Satsuma domain, where there really were a lot of rebellious elements. And that came about partly because of marriage politics. The Kuroda family of Fukuoka had married into the shogunal line, and also the lord of the domain at that time was actually born a Shimada, which was from Satsuma, and he was adopted. He was adopted into the Kuroda family and became its heir as a kind of mukoyoshi, and so that put the Fukuoka domain in a kind of interesting position because they were able to be this middleman, but it also created difficulties for them because they had to try to again do a balancing act between pleasing the staying on the good side of the shogunate and also not antagonizing their Satsuma relatives. That was Nagahiro, who was Kuroda Nagahiro, who was domain lord at the time. He actually had a kind of ambivalent relationship with loyalism for a long time, but especially after first Choshu expedition, the punitive expedition, he went all out against the loyalists then. And that had an ironic result that, unlike Choshu, a lot of later Meiji leaders came from the Choshu domain, but hardly any of them came from, I don't think any of them came from the Fukuoka domain. That's probably because most of them were executed. A lot of them were. And Boto was one of the survivors of the purges. And I think that that's one reason that she's kind of a local hero. That's one thing, one factor maybe.
Yeah, it's such a delicate situation that she was in. And just in case some of our listeners might not be familiar with the geographical location of these domains, so Fukuoka domain was kind of between the capital and the southern domains from Kyushu, where the loyalists first started to riot against the Bakufu armies. So that's something important to keep in mind. You mentioned that Nomura was a dedicated waka poet. Apparently, she gained a considerable reputation for her waka poems. So at that time, how popular was waka learning in this region? And were there any differences from waka practices before this period, say from the Han period? Because we don't often see female waka poets until the early modern period. Is that correct?
Well, yes. Actually, the area, the Hakata Fukuoka area, had a long literary tradition that goes way back to the Manyoshu period. And so there had been a lot of literary activity there from early times. But there were no real differences stylistically until you get very close to the end of the early modern period. And then you have schools of poets like Kotomichi. You see a great deal of vernacularization in their poetry. And from the beginning of the early modern period, there was this inexorable move away from court dominance of poetry. The early modern period began with almost total monopoly of the art by court poets. Insisted on maintaining certain secret practices, and they were the only teachers. They were the only ones who really got it. But more and more that was contested. It was contested, of course, by the rise of Kokugaku, but more in the Fukuoka domain, in that area especially, by poets like Kotomichi. This vernacularization, he didn't give a hoot about the court precedent. He didn't care for the Kokugaku poets either. He really steered a maverick course. And a lot of his poetry has been called haikai-like, or it has much of the ambience of a haiku. And that's one thing that I always found especially interesting about his poetry. And so, that's part of a trend toward decentralization. Until the 19th century, there was what could be called a kadan, establishment poets, establishment poetry, and dominant schools. But there was a movement away from that, especially toward the Bakumatsu period. Nobody really cared about that anymore. And so that decentralization gave birth to these distinctive styles like that.
You also mentioned that the rise of nativist studies, or Kokugaku, had profound influence on Waka poetry towards the late Tokugawa period. So in what aspects did they differ on ways to write Waka, and why?
Well, with the rise of nativism, there was, of course, they rejected any claim of court prerogative in Waka composition. They turned instead to pre-aristocratic models, the manyoshu in particular, and so a lot of the styles of poetry that arose out of that used a lot of self-conscious archaisms. They went back beyond the standard Heian diction and lexicon, and went back to use archaic terms in their poetry that were very hard to understand. A lot of them wrote in Manyogana because they thought that gave it more of an ancient ambience. There was also the rise of the restoration of Choka, because Choka had kind of been neglected for many centuries. So they saw this manyo-centered approach as predating court dominance. And out of that came a new style, especially with the rise of loyalism, came what is called shishigin, or patriot's verse. A lot of it was written by loyalists with very little poetic talent, but boy, were they passionate. And then so they poured their passion into their verse. Loyalists were expected to commit their passion to this style of verse. As I mentioned in some places in the book, this presented a bit of a problem for female loyalists, because patriot verse style was decidedly masculine in tone, and women were expected to be a little more delicate, a little more taoyame budi, and that sort of thing. And so it was difficult for them to strike the right tone in writing this kind of verse. Also the loyalists tended to be anti-foreign in general, and so that's why they liked Waka. Pretty much until the Meiji period, Waka used only native diction, Wago. It didn't use Kango at all, and so it was seen as a pure expression of the Japanese spirit. So that's why composition in it was kind of sacramentalized for these people.
And did Boto write a lot of these patriot verses as well?
She did write some. I'll have to kind of paraphrase the verse. I didn't put a bookmark in it, I'm afraid. But one verse she says she wrote to a person departing to Kyoto to act as a guard. She said, "If I were one who bore armor. That is, if I were a man wearing armor, do you think I'd be one step behind you in performing this duty? That's paraphrasing it, but that's basically the sense of the poem. And so she did write a poetry like that. Maybe I can. Let me get my glasses here. Yeah. Okay, here's one. Yeah. Oh, yeah, here that verse is. Would I arrive even a step after you if I were numbered among those who bear the catalpa bow, meaning the bow of a warrior? And another one that she wrote, when she had a dream, and she writes a lot about her dreams, and dreams are very important to her. But she had a dream about the approach of foreign ships, and she wrote, even in a dream on a night in spring, instead of blossoms, an onslaught of foreign ships. So she had that preoccupation with these kurobune that were making incursions into Japan. And that was actually written before her radicalization, but so she did write these kinds of verses.
You also talked in the book that the role of the four-class social structure that we briefly talked about earlier, in the story of Boto, as well as how her story defies this structure. Can you talk more about this aspect?
Yes. Well, I think most of us, when we first started studying Japanese history and so forth, we came across this idea of Shino Kosho, the samurai, peasant, artisan, merchant, in descending order, supposedly. I think a lot of us came away with the idea that these were very rigid, and that they were somehow written into law. Of course, there was a lot of rigidity about the way they were practiced, but it seems that it was actually more a matter of custom than of law. But it was a very rigid custom, nevertheless, and these customs started to give way, to break down toward the Bakumatsu period. We find more association between commoners and samurai in many ways. We find them attending the same schools together, the same academies together, which in an earlier generations would not have occurred. We see that Boto herself studied waka under Kotomichi, who was from the merchant class, and she was very devoted to him. And she took students, poetry students herself, from different classes. So there was this kind of fraying of this social class structure, of course, a lot of commoners were being given the privilege of using surnames and carrying swords. There's some evidence that a few of the wealthy merchants even purchased that privilege. But they were supposed to have been given the privilege because of some meritorious deed. But anyway, toward the end of the period, we see commoners fighting in militias. The Shinsengumi. The Shinsengumi included numerous commoners that were recruited from among peasants and other commoner groups. In the Choshu domain, Takasugi's Kiheitai also recruited a lot of commoners. So there was a breakdown of these social classes toward the end of the period. And Boto illustrates that in many ways.
Yeah. Shinsengumi is actually the reason I got into Japanese studies, which is such
really?
A cliche. not nearly as interesting as Boto's story. In your book, the role of gender is another very important theme, because during the time that Boto lived, there probably weren't many women like her to get this involved in publishing or taking disciples or voicing their political views. So could you maybe tell us more about this part?
Well, of course, from the Manyoshu period onward, there was never a period when women didn't compose waka. They always did. But from the medieval period on, figures like Abutsuni and those figures from about her time until nearly the 19th century, even though women composed lots of waka, they weren't as visible. They were not publishing collections. They didn't have as much of a public role in waka composition. And this also changed toward the end of the Tokugawa period. You have the appearance of a number of women who were very prominent as poets, and who did teach, and they even taught men as Boto herself did, and in an earlier generation that would have been highly unlikely, but it wasn't unheard of in her period. So you couldn't say it was commonplace, but it was not unheard of. Nobody was really shocked by it anymore.
That's fascinating. What about the atmosphere of that time that may have influenced her writings? You mentioned briefly in the book, and there recently have been studies about this Milan-Ran atmosphere, where we have these events such as the Ejanaika dance, where people got in the streets, they were chanting about the end of the world, and this was sort of an atmosphere that lasted until after even the Meiji Restoration. So how did such an environment shape or impact both those writings?
I quote Victor Turner, who is very well known as a cultural anthropologist, and he's written a lot about this phenomenon, which he calls liminality, and liminality is transgressing the limen, challenging the norms and practices of the old regime, and in this case, the old regime would have been the shogunate itself. But these times come about in a period of perceived crisis. People, there's kind of a crisis mentality that pervades society, and a certain element of society wants to reclaim, go back to some primal state of purity. And you certainly see that in a lot of it was given a kind of intellectual foundation by much Kokugaku writing, but Turner also says that people in this state tend to utilize liminoid genres, literary genres, and for Boto, I think that waka was that kind of liminoid genre. She combined a historical time with mythical time, and especially in her case, I think you could say oniric time, that is dream time, because she placed so much emphasis on dreams. the opening lines of her diary, The Counting of Dreams, Counting Dreams. It resonates throughout the entire diary, and you can sense that she felt this impending change, huge structural changes that were imminent, and that affected her writing, especially during her incarceration and her remaining years in Choshu. You see it especially there. Her last collection of poetry, the Boshu Diary, it's very millennialist in tone. It's as if she expected a whole new world to open up with the fall of the shogunate. So
she was very active in participating in these political events, and she also, as you mentioned earlier, actively voiced her opinions about these events. How did she write about it? And do you see any transformations in her writing throughout time?
Well, yes, there are definitely transformations. I think her writing could be put into three periods. Her earliest period, when she began her tutelage under Kotomichi, until Kotomichi's departure to Kyoto and her husband's death. That first period, her poetry was, I wouldn't say conventional, because it was unique. It was unlike Kotomichi's in many ways, but she had a distinctive style, and it was the poetry from that period is very good, and I include many translations from it in my book. The period of her political awakening, I guess you'd say, up through her incarceration, is another period. There is a noted stylistic change there, shift. You can see she's much more preoccupied with the Tenjin cult, the cult of Michizane. And she observes those things with much more fastidiousness. And that's all tied in with her growing political vision. And then the third phase would be her remaining years in Choshu, where her poetry and her writing is very millenarian in tone. So you can see those shifts throughout her writing.
With this much writing, what kind of legacy do you think she left?
Well, she left a very diverse one. Actually, a lot of Bakumatsu figures have been treated in historical fiction, film, plays, and a lot of them have Yoshida Shoin, for example, Saigo Takamori, all of those figures, they've been repeatedly portrayed, and their portrayal has changed with each age to suit different audiences, tastes, and demands, and worldviews. And in that sense, Boto is no different, I think. But in at least one respect, she is very different, and that is the way she was treated had as much to do with the fact that she was a woman as it had to do with changing tastes of audience. And I think that you can see that in a number of instances. For example, just a few years after her death, there was an account of her life, a brief account, just a few paragraphs. Kinsei Seigi Jinmei Zoden, Illustrated Biographies of Latter-day Champions of Justice, that came out in 1874, that was just years after her death, but and it's from that that the cover of the book is taken from that. But anyway, it's interesting that in that account she's identified as the wife of Sadatsura, her husband, and as the grandmother of Habuku, her grandson. So as if she could only derive her identity from the men in her life. But the interesting thing is that readers would not have known who those men were. And the poem that is cited in that work isn't even her poem. It's someone else's poem. And so it gives very scant treatment of her. So it gives hardly any idea of who she was. And then in the in later works, Meiji through Taisho, we see a lot of emphasis on, she was an activist, and she did all of these things, but she was also thoroughly grounded in the traditional feminine arts of poetry. They mention poetry as if that's an exclusively feminine art, and sewing, and flower arranging, and tea ceremony. She was good at all of those things too, that were necessary to justify her being involved as an activist as well. So that was kind of interesting. A lot of later Taisho works portray her as kind of a nurturing figure to the loyalists. She was sort of their mom, you know. In fact, some of them even called her Shishi no Haha, the mother to the loyalists. So she was this mother figure to them. And we see that in some Taisho period treatments of her. As we move into the war years and the rise of militarism, of course, she takes upon a much more martial aspect in those works, and she appears in numerous school readers for the period to inspire the women of Japan. See, you can be as valiant as she was. And the treatments after the war, the post-war period, are interesting. They portray her as more of a peacemaker. They put less emphasis on the martial aspects. One in particular, Morota Reiko, I'm impressed with her writing. She's a tremendously talented novelist, but her treatment of Boto, she introduces a lot of amorous elements into it. One of the loyalists that she associated with was. Let's see, if I can find a place here, I can maybe read a line or two from it. When she. In Moroto's account, when she goes to Choshu in her remaining years, she meets Takasugi's concubine, and she actually did. That part of it is historical, but in this account, she kind of became a mentor to this concubine, and. She Ouno, who is the name of the concubine, says, "Strange, this hand of yours." And Boto says, "I too once had my hand squeezed like this, or rather, I was the one who first extended the hand. It really did lighten my heavy heart." "Oh, whose hand did you squeeze?" "A neighbor's, a fellow loyalist, someone I was in love with." And this was after her husband's death, of course, but even so, just introducing that entirely fictitious amorous element, I mean, it works as fiction, but but it takes a lot of liberties if you're from the historical account. And then Boto has also appeared in a couple of Taiga dorama that have aired. And also, I might mention, in the Taisho period, there were a couple of non-historical features that were portrayed that have been kind of found their way almost into sort of historical treatments. The idea that Gesho visited her, which there's no basis for that at all, or that Saigo Takamori visited her at her hermitage. There's no basis for that, but this myth started that Boto was responsible for bringing Takasugi Shinsaku and Saigo Takamori together, and that made for the Sacho Dome, the alliance between Satsuma and Choshu. And of course, that's entirely fictitious, but there seem to be some people who seriously believe that happened because of these works of fiction. So anyway, she's had a very diverse legacy.
She does indeed. I think it's quite a pity how female historical figures have been treated in scholarships or even on media. So I guess at least all these fictionalization about her is better than Hollywood making a movie of her, casting a white actress or something. But in the introduction part, you briefly talked about problems with writings on female historical figures. Other than these problems that we've just talked about, what else are there, and how does your book deal with these problems when writing about Boto?
Well, actually, I'm not confident that I will satisfy every reader in this respect, but the problems are various. One is a lack of pioneering studies on the lives of samurai women. Now, there have been some very good studies in English on women of the Bakumatsu. There's Anne Walthall's work on, and also Laura Nenzi, her work on Kurosawa Tokiko. Both of those works treat women of the commoner class, and a number of writers, Japanese critics as well, have noted that treatments of early modern women have not been that plentiful to begin with, and most of them that there are have focused on commoners. And here I was treating a woman of the samurai class, so that brought in a whole different dimension. And also there's the problem of how to deal with problems of the age that women faced, striking a right balance with a tendency. In some writing, you see what I think is a tendency to kind of exaggerate or hyperbolize, as if every woman in Japan from the period was haunted by the Onna Daigaku and so forth. Boto certainly wasn't, and she even came from the domain that it purportedly sprang from, you know. But she obviously was not, and I find that that a lot of these accounts really beg for more nuance, you know. But on the other hand, I don't want to minimize the trials, the difficulties that women of the period faced. It was a very oppressive regime, and it wasn't. It was oppressive for everyone, men and women. But women had their own peculiar difficulties that they faced. There was also this. I'm not sure that I tried preemptively anticipating accusations from some readers that I haven't consulted this or that feminist critic. And again, I approached Botto initially as a person, as a poet, and her gender was secondary to that. But I think that her accomplishments stand on their own merit. But I don't know. Maybe some people will be dissatisfied that I didn't consult this or that school of thought. But I do try to throughout the book. Look at the problems that are posed by her gender, and that in travel and in various activities that she engaged in. So anyway, I'll find out when I see the reviews whether I'm.
For what it's worth, I definitely thought your angles, looking into her poems and diaries and taking all things into account, I didn't think it would have needed too much theoretical support, especially from feminist theories.
It's reassuring to hear that.
Okay. And I certainly hope to see more studies like this that can look into female historical figures from more various angles, rather than relying solely on theories, for that matter. But yeah, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. It was very thought-provoking.
Well, thank you.
And for our listeners, to learn more about Botto's adventurous life, make sure you check out this new book by Dr. Roger Thomas, Counting Dreams, The Life and Writings of the Loyalist Nun Nomura Botto. This is Jing Yi from New Books in Japanese Studies, and I will see you soon.